from two guys who don't leave early to beat the traffic. It's At the Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith.
It's At the Letters for Tuesday, September 29th in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, on sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. Please like, share, favorite, and subscribe. Leave a review. Click five stars, or, you know, if you don't think it's worth five stars, maybe click less. But of course it's worth five stars. And of course today it's going to be worth five stars, because we're going to be joined by a very, very special guest. Stephen Brunt is going to join us, and we're going to have a very long conversation about the Toronto Blue Jays, about Jose Bautista, about Edwin Encarnacion, who he went down to see both of them in the Dominican Republic over the last few years. He's got some really interesting insight into that. I perhaps should have mentioned earlier, my name is Arden Zwelling. I am your host on At the Letters. Normally, I'm joined by Ben Nicholson-Smith. He is off this week as he is attending an incredibly poorly timed wedding during the week that the Blue Jays are likely to clinch the American League East. But Ben is here with us in spirit, and he'll be back next week as we get into this Blue Jays playoff that's about to happen. The Blue Jays have not clinched yet, but their magic number is two as it stands right now. They are likely to clinch either tonight in Baltimore or tomorrow in Baltimore. And I can tell you, from talking to some Blue Jays over the weekend, during the initial celebration for reaching the postseason, they cannot wait to tear that Orioles clubhouse apart. Ceiling tiles are going to be ripped out of that place. They're going to have to escort them all out via security. I think the party you are going to see when the Blue Jays clinch is going to make Saturday's festivities look like Chuck E. Cheese. All of that said, let's get on with it. This is At the Letters on Sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. After the break, we will be joined by the one, the only, Stephen Brunt. Stay with us.
This is Encarnacion, and get up, and down. Edwin Encarnacion, another home run, his third against Tillman, his 36th of the season. Swing in the drive, deep to left, Bautista has gone deep again, into the second deck.
It's At the Letters on Sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. Arden Zwelling here. Very pleased to be joined by a man who wears many hats for the Sportsnet brand, whether television, radio, print, the back page of Sportsnet magazine, Stephen Brunt. Stephen, how are you?
I think this is the first time I've worn the podcast hat.
Welcome.
In my career. So there you go. Yeah. And I've done a lot of stuff.
You haven't done any podcast.
No, I've not. Something I've done is probably wound up on a podcast, but I've never actually done a podcast per se.
All right. Well, this will be good. The maiden voyage. You can say pretty much anything you want.
Is that the rule?
Yeah. Okay.
the rule is there are no rules. Okay.
Yeah,
that's
exactly. Excellent. I thought this was a really perfect time to have you on, just because I was in the clubhouse on Saturday as the Blue Jays were celebrating. And I noticed, the two of the guys who were really enjoying themselves, Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion. Eddie actually kind of started that celebration. What was supposed to be a toast, and it kind of went around saying, like, hey, how did this turn into like a crazy party? It said Eddie got it going. And I remember one moment when Bautista was talking to us in the media, and Edwin Encarnacion kind of came up behind him and put his arm around him and poured some champagne in his mouth and said, hey, sorry, we need to enjoy this. We've been waiting years for this. What did that say to you? Just know the way you know those guys.
Well, they're very different guys.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we have a tendency to lump all of, never mind lump all the Latino guys together, but especially lump all the Dominican guys together and say, well, they're Dominican, so they're like this and they think this way, or they're all buddies, or, when the Jays had that, after the 2013 deal, and they had not just those guys, but Melky and Bonifacio and Reyes was still around, there was this kind of like Dominican national team thing going on.
Right. Yeah.
And everybody's, kind of assumed that there was so there is a camaraderie among them, but they are very different people. And, which makes sense. And those two guys, especially, they're different folks. They come from a different strata of the Dominican population, and they think differently. I'll tell you the common element would be that both guys, It's been an interesting journey for both of those guys as ball players, I think that this is as sweet for them as it's going to be for anybody.
You can kind of draw that parallel between them as, guys who were cast away by former teams.
Yep.
And everyone kind of, they were written off by baseball, and the Blue Jays brought them in and said, hey, just come here, be yourselves, and let's see if, we can unlock something with you. And they've both had kind of similar stories in that sense. I mean, who do you think it meant more for? Or is that even a fair question?
It's a tough one because it's different, right? And right. Like Eddie, and again, I say this, I'm not pretending that I, hang out with him on the weekend and stuff, but because I was lucky enough to go to the Dominican. I've been down there a bunch of times now for Sportsnet, and it's different talking to guys on their home ground. Yeah. And it means something to the Dominican guys that you go there. It's it matters to them that you're there. They want you to see the place and to understand the place. They're incredibly hospitable, when you're there. So it allows you a degree of intimacy with them that you might not get on an everyday basis in the clubhouse. So that's, one of my many regrets, but one of my regrets, if I'd known I was going to get into this business, a long time ago, I would have learned to speak Spanish.
I've had that thought so many times.
It would have changed a lot of things because, it really is the second language of the clubhouse. In some clubhouses, it's the first language, and mm-hmm. it's really tricky, sometimes I think guys are misunderstood sometimes, and I think that they're, a guy like Edwin is very shy about his English. His English is fine.
Yeah.
But, I think sometimes he feels like he's not going to be fully understood, so he just doesn't talk. But, he is, let's start with him, he's a sensitive guy. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things. And I, it wasn't just that, he kind of found himself in Toronto. It's that, he came here. There was the whole E5 thing. Remember, he's playing at third base, and the fans were booing him and making fun of him.
Not that long ago.
And that really hurt him. He was really hurt by that. And, if you talked to people who know him as well, they'll tell you the same thing, that it was really tough for him. And, I think sometimes as a fan, you just yell stuff at guys and you figure it doesn't, just rolls off their back, right? Because they're athletes, they're performers, they're supposed to just take it. But that was a tough time for him. And, and even during the time, kind of that time of his rebirth, they released him, right? He was gone. He was picked up by Oakland.
Yeah.
Then they released him without ever, he never, obviously, in the offseason, right? He was only there for a matter of days, as I recall.
Yeah.
And the Jays kind of re-signed him, but there was no real, the commitment to him came very late in terms of there was still a fair bit of skepticism about Edwin and whether he would stick around here. So, he's a guy who hit a lot of bumps in the road before he found himself, right. Which is why, the hat trick night, I was watching that. I wasn't at the park, but I was watching on TV. And I tell you, I got a little, I almost had a tear in my eye.
Right.
I did have a tear in my eye because, watching him like process what was happening there, right? Just because he had no idea why people are throwing hats.
Yeah.
But obviously it's full stadium, crazy excitement. He has one of those kind of nights that if you're a Dominican or a Canadian, you dream of. You grow up and you say, boy, what it would be like, hitting a home run in a major league ballpark, 3 home runs, and then just all that love cascading down.
Yeah.
And I can see in him and kind of knowing what a big mush he is. That meant a lot to him. It was beautiful and it was great. And I'm not sure anyone on that team would have appreciated it more than him. So, but he comes from a place called La Romana.
Right.
It's a sugar town. It's owned by the sugar company, the La Romana Sugar Company. It's like a company town.
Big sugar.
Yeah. The guys, you can look up the guys who own the company. They're two Cuban American guys that 60 Minutes did a big expose on them.
I remember.
Or not 60 Minutes, Fifth Estate. Not nice guys.
I remember your story on it.
Yeah. They got a mill in the middle of town, belches black smoke all day long. They have these rail cars that creak through town with the sugar cane that the even poorer Haitians who work for the Dominicans are out cutting it by hand and putting it on ox carts in the stifling heat. So it looks like some kind of industrial nightmare.
Right.
And, he grew up in the poor side of town and now he lives on the rich side of town. It's, but very, very close to his roots still. So that's Eddie.
I fans have an interesting relationship with Edwin Encarnacion, and I think he's a bit misunderstood in a lot of, you mentioned the E5 thing, and I think that a lot of it, there's that in his introduction to Toronto fans, there's the fact that he doesn't do a lot of on-camera stuff.
Almost none.
People don't get to know him, and because he is absolutely sensitive about the language and about how he's perceived, and he's also just not kind of a guy who wants the spotlight on him.
Yeah.
He doesn't really seek that, I don't think. And then, the third bit of it is honestly, I think his facial expression and just when, his just kind of resting face is one of, a man who he just doesn't naturally look happy.
Although he's got the greatest smile in the world, right?
Well, I was just going to say, I remember that the hat day, I wrote the game story that day, and the way I wrote it was, you know, Edwin Encarnacion had a smile you can't fake. And it was like, that was absolutely legitimate and genuine. And you want to talk about like a sweetheart guy. Edwin Encarnacion is that guy.
Oh, he is. You know, and it was a kick at, like, again, you see these guys in context. And I'll talk about Bautista in a minute because it's very different. But, you know, Eddie, so we go down to visit him, and he's got a nice house that he lives in now, but not a compound, right? It's in the city, and it's
within his means.
It's probably way within his means, given it's a Dominican and given what he makes as a ball player. But he's got a sister and a brother, Evelyn and Julio, who are there, and his mom and dad. His dad was a track coach, and he's kind of a flamboyant guy, right? It's interesting because his mom's quiet, sort of like Eddie is, and the dad's kind of flamboyant. Right. And so even with we're working through translators with him, but he's kind of got a big attitude. Right.
Right.
And he talks about, you know, his own accomplishments and so we're sitting there talking to him and to Eddie's sister and brother and the mom. And there's all these other people wandering around the place. Right. And they're all kind of roughly the same age, you know, kind of people in their 20s and teens and early 30s maybe. And I was talking to Evelyn, his sister, and I said, so who's that guy? And she said, oh, that's my brother so-and-so. And I said, who's that? Oh, no, that's my brother. And I said, and I finally said, look, you know, I thought it was just, you said it was just the three of you. He said, well, yes, it is. But my dad, he's a crazy guy. So the dad has spread his genetic material far and wide in La Romana. And there are all these kind of half brothers and sisters floating around, but they're all kind of there, right? So there's this kind of moving feast of, you know, Encarnacion's floating around at all hours, all the time. Eddie's got a son, Edwin Jr., who's this lovely kid who he's around
all the time.
Yeah, a sweet kid. And Eddie, you know, is a great, loving dad. It's and then they go back to the old neighborhood all the time, which is, again, across the river. And Eddie there's a block where he lived, where he grew up. And the house where he lived is actually torn down. It's just a foundation now. But he went back, bought that lot, and ended up buying up almost this whole block and kind of allowing the people who lived there already in this very poor neighborhood to continue living there.
Right.
And so he hauls, you know, he'll haul ass in there in one of his sports cars. He likes fast cars. So he's driving around this little tiny town, like there's nowhere to go, but he's driving around in a Ferrari or a dune buggy or something, going 100 miles an hour, roars in. And then we just hung out there for a day. When the guys were just drinking beer and playing Vitilla, the street baseball game, and you know, it's the old home and the old block, but he essentially is kind of taking care of everybody on that block.
He is very much a big kid in that sense.
Yeah,
he loves the cars and he loves the remote control. You know, you'll see him throw up flying his drone around the Rogers Center, and you know, with the toy cars and everything like that, and the Vitilla in the clubhouse. I mean, he's very much a grown kid. He also has a real sense of where he came from and how things could have gone very differently for him.
Yes.
You know, even up until his early years in Toronto.
Yeah. And I would say, again, there's another level in the Dominican. Like, you can get down to it. Like, Eddie would be middle class, right? Because his dad had a job as a track coach. You know, they had a house.
Yeah.
You know, there's the strata in the Dominican in terms of, like, there's guys who play ball here who grew up with way, way less than he did.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of them who try and play ball and never get out of it. So, you know, he grew up in relative comfort, but he is still very aware of where he comes from, very much family guy of the place. You know, it's funny, and I never like to kind of vouch for people off the field, because I've learned over the years that I have no idea, right?
You can be wrong.
Never say a guy's a great human being because of they're a great hockey player, a great baseball player, a great football, because you don't know, right? But I saw the guy in his own environment a bit. I saw him with his family.
Yeah.
You know, I'd kind of vouch for Eddie, I think.
A lot of people have said Oscar Pistorius is a great guy.
Yeah, well, look, I did an inspirational piece about him in the Olympics in London, which is the best thing I did over there, and I hope no one ever sees it again. That's when I kind of hope is consigned to the vault.
Do you think there was a turning point for Eddie in Toronto? And was it as simple as just getting away from third base, or was it, you know, was there a point where, you know, things kind of clicked for him?
I think that was the biggest part of it. You know, just that I think it ate him up. You know, the kind of anxiety about playing the position. It's a hard position.
You could see it at the plate. He was taking it there with him.
Yeah,
you
know? I think so. And I think once they took that away from, you know, he's an adequate first baseman, but he's quite happy to DH, though, as you know. Right?
Oh, yeah,
he's one of those guys that Don't worry about that. There's other guys that, remember George Bell here a million years ago fought tooth and nail to not be a DH.
Yeah.
Now don't, because you would be humiliating him because it was half the game. But Edwin's the guy who, yeah, I'm a DH. That's fine. Just let me hit. And yeah. you look and you can tell he's one of those guys, right? You've watched him play enough. You can tell when he's messed up, either physically or timing wise.
Yeah.
But when he locks in, it's beautiful watching him hit breaking balls.
Yeah.
When he's locked in.
Yeah.
I've never seen a guy who, can adjust. Even if a guy's throwing heat, he can kind of rock. Does that little rock back thing, and he'll hammer a curveball or a changeup, as though it was somebody throwing slow pitch to him.
Right. And you think about a guy with a swing like his that's so explosive and so powerful, and for him to lay off of pitches it takes a lot.
It does. It absolutely does. But he worked again. I saw him down there working too. He was working with Cano, and Cano was they share a hitting coach.
Right.
And that's the guy. That's the guy that takes credit for Eddie's transformation. There are a lot of those guys, those kind of guru types out there, but there's a hitting coach in the Dominican who would take credit for him and for Robbie Cano and probably a host of others. So, he's available if anybody wants to hire him.
And then, so when you look at Jose Bautista, what's kind of the difference in, his, how he's maybe approaching this moment and the next couple of weeks?
Well, he's a different cat. And, again, I always kind of go back with him to kind of where he comes from in the kind of socioeconomic strata down there. He grew up, his parents are both professional, right? So his dad ran had an engineering degree and ran a factory. And his mom, I think, was in a kind of accounting, bookkeeping, right? But they both gone to college. He was educated in English schools and private schools, grew up in Santo Domingo in the capital. So he's not a country guy. Like, Jose Reyes comes from like a place at the end of a dirt road somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Bautista's a downtown Santo Domingo guy, and he for him to play baseball was a step down.
Right.
I remember him telling me the first time he actually met poor people in the Dominican was when he played baseball.
Really?
Because he didn't grow up in that world at all, right? Yeah. He didn't understand, so suddenly he's cast in among, because again, if you go to the Dominican, it's like it's all the cliches are true. If you drive around a corner in the city, there'll be a big empty lot and there'll be 500 kids playing ball.
Yeah.
Not necessarily playing organized baseball, but gloves and bats and the street agents and all that stuff it's all the time everywhere. But he did not come out of that at all. He's a different guy. And part of him wants you to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So went to college in the States. Yeah. He's got a lot of business interests and he would not like to be lumped in with all the other Dominican guys.
Right.
He wants you to know that. And I think sometimes that, he almost sees that as his role in the clubhouse.
Yeah.
He's been the big dog in the Jays clubhouse for a while now in any case, but he's definitely the big dog among the Dominicans.
Right.
And so there's, I think there's probably all kinds of complications in terms of class and color and economics in the Dominican that outsiders don't fully understand.
Yeah.
It's probably pretty nuanced.
Right. Do you feel he feels a responsibility to kind of represent a more, but a more refined kind of Dominican individual in the majors?
Yeah, I do. Yeah? I do. Again, I think he wants people to see him in a particular way.
Yeah.
And, he's a bit prickly about it, as you know. Anybody's dealt with him, right? He's not easy. Right. He's not a backslapper. And he's not a guy that, he doesn't seek out the camera necessarily after games. Some guys are want to be there. He's not that guy. But if you engage with him, you better be ready to kind of engage on his terms. But it could be a really interesting conversation. Like, the most interesting conversation I ever had with him was about kind of the relationship between, Americans and Dominicans, given that the Americans invaded in 65 and kind of Dominican-American history, the push-pull of that. And, it was great. I learned a ton. It was a really interesting discussion. He's a smart cat. They say a smart cat who would like you to know he's a smart cat.
When you enter a conversation with him, you have to prepare to be challenged on things you say.
Yep.
When you talk to a lot of athletes, you're not going to be challenged on a lot. You can kind of put it in cruise control. You really have to be on your toes when you talk to Jose Bautista, because even semantically.
Yes.
That's
exactly right.
He'll let you know.
Oh, he'll come right back at you. Right? Like, I always figure most of them don't listen to the question anyway, because they're just going to give you the answer they're going to give you.
Yeah.
Listen to 99% of post games, right? It doesn't matter what you what the question is.
They're listening for that key word.
Yeah.
You know?
And then
ninth inning.
Yeah. And then they go into autopilot and you get what you get, right? But with him, no, he listens and he gives you that look. Yeah. And
you know it's coming.
Yeah. And I say it's not always been look, I think again, we went down there.
Yeah.
And unlike Edwin, you know, Edwin opened the doors, mm-hmm. right? We had full access to him and his family. Jose did not.
Right.
His, you know, his girlfriend was down there. He had one kid at that point, and he's got two now.
Yeah.
We didn't meet them. Right. We met him outside of his apartment. We went to the gym with him. Yeah. He took us out for dinner to show us the city a little bit, which was great. He pointed us in the direction of a great cigar bar, which I visited on every Dominican trip since. It was an awesome, kind of this weird, high-end cigar bar in the middle of the squalor of Santo Domingo.
Yeah.
But he's not, he's not the warmest guy in the world.
Right.
It's he's way more guarded. You know, and but what I've found is that if you sit him down and talk to him, he will answer questions. And as you say, it's a two-way street, right?
Oh, absolutely. Did you get a greater appreciation of who he is away from the field just from going down there? Because, I mean, so few people have even gotten that level of access, which you said was somewhat restricted. So few people have even gotten that.
Yeah. I kind of think I got what he wanted me to get.
Right.
And the other thing is, I'm not sure how much time he spends there anymore, right? I think mostly he's in
Lives
Florida.
In Tampa, yeah.
And I'm not sure how much, because he had the place in Santo Domingo. It was interesting, you know, you could pick things up because it was, you know, again, of where he lived. It wasn't the flashy place. Nice condo, but it was right in the heart. It's a really noisy, dirty city.
Right.
And you can live in the Dominican on a green hill looking out over the water where no one would bug you. He lived right in the center of it. So he's urban, right? Yeah. He's that guy, and he wanted to be right there. You know, I think the thing he always, you know, the easiest things to talk to him about are stuff, well, business stuff, right?
Yeah.
You know, I remember we had dinner with him and a buddy of his from a guy who was a Dominican guy living in Canada, but we were in the Dominican, and he came along for dinner, and all he and Jose talked about was Toronto real estate.
Yeah.
That was the conversation.
He's very business-minded.
Yeah.
Absolutely. When you look at, I mean, the Booster Juice stuff, the jeans, Marucci bats, that's all by design. And that's all Jose pushing that. Like, I'm not sure there's, like, he obviously has help with it, but with some guys where they might have a financial manager or someone who's like, hey, you should really do this, you should do that. It's Jose who constantly wants to do more and more.
That's right.
A lot of that might have to do with the fact he's been criminally underpaid for years.
Yeah. Now, you could see, in hindsight, yes.
Yeah.
You know, at the time, it was mutual risk because the Jays were investing in a guy who had only done it for a short time, right? Yeah. And he was a guy who was going to get a security, you know, having not done it for a long time, but it was, mm-hmm. It was locking in a team. There's risk on both sides. So, market value-wise, he's been criminally underpaid. Which is one of the reasons I think the Jays are pretty sure he's going to go to market when his contract's up.
Right. That's the other thing I wanted to broach with you is of these two guys, I mean, you know, there's not this, when you look at this, these next couple of weeks of them going to the postseason and whatever happens, happens, this may be the high point in their careers with the Toronto Blue Jays. Like from here, there's a potential for things to get somewhat nasty in
Correct.
Terms of how these guys are either going to leave town or stay in town. I mean, how do you see all that playing out?
Yeah, it's... Well, you know, obviously the team options next year, which they'll pick up, right? You know, and all those people who said they should have traded one or the other in the last 2 years without thinking about A, the production you were going to get from them, or B, the team-friendly contracts ought to give their heads a shake. You know?
$10 million for Eddie.
Yeah, it was always a ridiculous idea that you would trade these guys, you know, given what they could do for you and given where they were in their careers. Like, just even if you were trying to shed salary, this would be bad salary to shed.
Yeah.
But, I think it could get a little tricky if they don't. I think they will look. Put it this way, I think they'll open the door to extending both guys.
Mm-hmm.
I think there will be a conversation,
right?
And I think the belief is organizationally that Edwin is more likely to be open to that than Jose will be. Now, I asked Jose about it when we did the sit down the other day that ran the TV sit down, and he said all the right things. Right, likes it here, business interests here, would love to stay here. He's thrived here professionally, and then, but you know. It's one chance in your life as a ball player, right? That he's not going to have another shot at this kind of market value. If I was him, I probably would want to know what the market held.
He's going to be hitting at 36 too, is the interesting part about this.
Yeah, it is. Right? It is. But, you know, he'll do very, very well in the open market. And so would Eddie.
Yeah.
Right. I think either guy would, but I think there's a sense that Edwin, that the comfort zone here, you know, that he might not be as committed to getting every last dollar.
Right.
Because, look, if either guy wants to get every last dollar, they should take themselves to the market and see what happens. Yeah. And my guess is they probably wouldn't end up here.
Yeah.
And not that, and that's not about Rodgers being cheap or whatever. It's just, you know, it's probably not the time that you go to the wall for a guy at that stage in their career.
Oh, it's about mid-30s power hitter. I mean, it's there's not a lot of evidence that things are going to, you know, numbers are going to improve.
Yeah.
You know, they're only going to go in one direction.
And you don't pay for past performance on a team, you know. And again, the way the rest of this team is set up with Tulowitzki and Donaldson and Martin, you know, you're kind of set up with other guys as well. So, but I think if I was betting, I would bet the same way that, you know, people have suggested to me from inside, which is that Eddie stays and Jose goes.
I would agree with you. And I think that's part of the genius of Alex Anthopoulos this season in adding Donaldson to Tulowitzki, who are very controllable and, in Donaldson's case, very affordable. Tulowitzki's going to cost a lot of money, but he's, you know, costing what Jose Reyes was going to cost.
That's right.
So, you know, just getting those two guys, I mean, you can afford to lose one of Eddie and Bautista, maybe even both.
Yeah, I think so. And it's, you know, it's kind of, it's a mug's game to think 2 years ahead and think where this is going to be, right? Where we're going to be.
Alex proves that every year that there's no point in thinking forward.
Well, and I would like to, you know, you would like to think that if the team is going to be drawn upwards of 3 million people and the TV ratings are where they are and that the economics of the team change slightly, you know, and that doesn't mean they have to be at the top of the market all the time. You know, I think they should be smart, but there are going to be, you know, there are going to be options, I would think, in terms of the kind of self-imposed cap. If that still exists, I'm sure, you know, there'll be a budget. But I would think that, you know, we've always been led to believe that if people showed up and the revenues went up, that number would go up.
Right.
So I don't know what the playing field will be for the Toronto Blue Jays in terms of payroll in 2017. I have no clue, but, you know, I would assume we're not going to go into an austerity phase here. It would be a weird, time to do it.
I think there is a bit of a temptation as well to maybe think with the heart instead of the head, especially when it comes to Bautista and everything that he's meant for this organization. You're talking about one of the greatest Blue Jays of all time.
Yep.
Really, a guy who I think will be on the level of excellence someday. You know, a guy who's made his entire, you know, career of being an MVP caliber slugger has been in Toronto. I think there might be a bit of temptation to say, well, let's let this guy finish it out here.
But you can't do that.
You,
right? You can't run a ball club that way, I don't think. And I say that, like, you're right about him being on a very short list of the best Blue Jays of all time.
Yeah.
And I think this season, you know, I know he's won home run titles, but I think the way he's played this season with the bum shoulder, but the number with the walks, the quality at bats, the power, the flashes of power, you know, not getting exploited defensively, which is almost impossible considering the guy couldn't throw for the better part of 2 months.
Yeah.
I think this is his best season. If I was kind of holistically, I think this is his best year. And I know it's not his best year number wise, but how many bad at bats has this guy had this year? How many selfish at bats has he had this year? Like almost none.
Well, the theatrics have been toned down so much since earlier in his career.
But you know, that's kind of, he needs to, that's part of him, right?
Yeah.
Like I think he's a guy who needs to feel underappreciated on some level to be motivated.
Right.
Like, I think it kind of goes together with him.
That, yeah.
You know, the utility player, you know, that the chip on his shoulder is almost necessary for him. I don't think it would be ever good for him to be completely, feel that he was completely appreciated and comfortable, because I think it would turn down the juice a bit.
And a bit of part of what makes him such a pleasure to watch is a bit of that recklessness and is a bit of that, you know, I mean, trying to gun out runners at third base, the stuff he does on the base paths. I mean, some of the times he goes for stolen bases, things like that.
Yeah, you wonder about it, right? Yeah, if we're a guy, you know, making out to third base where you go, like, why? What are you thinking? Trying to throw out a runner at first base just because he was pissed off, right? Like,
that's part of what makes him great.
But that is part of what makes him great. Yeah, I think it's part of that's the package, right? Yeah. And I'll make that trade-off any day.
Yeah. That was absolutely fascinating. You'll stick around for another segment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. We'll talk some more Blue Jays after this as we continue with Stephen Brunt on At the Letters.
Deux balles de prise à Russell Martin et voilà le signal de McCann. La balle est frappée avec Poisson Chargo. Et elle est partie!
It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling here with Stephen Brunt. We're on sportsnet.ca. We're also on iTunes. You can read all of Brunt's great work in Sportsnet magazine, sportsnet.ca. Watch his essays, and I'm sure there'll be some. You got a sit down coming up with Jose Bautista. You already did that one.
Bautista's done, yeah. And I did Tulowitzki. So those are both floating around somewhere in that space. And then Edwin, and I think a season ending long form chat with Alex Anthopoulos, which I'm really looking forward
to. That'll be great.
Yeah, that should be fun.
How'd you find Tulo?
To the point. Yeah. I wondered if there was any part of his brain that was not baseball. He warmed up a bit talking about his kid.
Really?
Taz. But I've been warned about that, right? People that are, you know, and if you go back and read the stuff in Denver, you know, the guys writing about him, like there's some really good writers there, you know, Kiesel and guys like that. No one really cracked that nut,
right,
what I could tell. But, you know, he was great. He was cordial. Yeah. And he was direct, but he's not warm and fuzzy, as you probably have picked up already.
When I'm in the clubhouse and I'm by his locker, I'm kind of looking for the can of oil that he uses.
The spare transistors or whatever. Right? Yeah, there's something. Yeah, but that's, I guess, again, another one of these things that's part of what appears to make him good, right? Like there was a story about, I read about him in Little League, because it reminded me, because when he had the collision with Pilar.
Right.
Story about how when he was in Little League, all the other kids' parents hated him and hated his father, who drove him pretty hard, because he was playing shortstop. Any ball in the infield, he played.
Yeah.
Like, it didn't matter. So it was like a pop-up to the second baseman. He just ran in front of him and took it. You know, and I was thinking about that when Pilar crashed into him, that, right, you know, it's every ball is his, right? And I guess he's got one of those dads.
Yeah. There's a lot of guys in the majors who have one of those dads.
Yeah, and he has a brother who he was – if I had more – time and it had been more, he'd been more open to it. He did allude to a brother for whom it didn't work out quite the same way.
Oh, really?
So the kind of Keith Gretzky of the Tulo family. So that might have been an interesting place to go.
You can draw a straight line from Troy Tulowitzki to Josh Donaldson in mindset, in that same idea of I'm going to catch every ball. Like, I'm going to do everything. I'm going to play every day. Like, I'm going to be so focused on baseball and winning. They might even rub some people the wrong way.
Yeah, and especially probably rubs you the wrong way if you're playing against them. Yeah. Right? I think that's why I think everybody's ever played against Donaldson hates him,
right,
from what I can tell. But yeah, I think even in a clubhouse, it could get a bit grating, mm-hmm, you know, it's like a Keener in school or something, right? Mm-hmm. If the guy, you know, who does everything by the letters, you would go, you know, other people kind of, you get annoyed by him. But if the guy's good enough and you're winning makes everybody fine, right? Mm-hmm. A clubhouse chemistry is basically BS, because every winning team I've ever seen is happy and every losing team I've ever seen is poisonous.
I think it's basically BS. It literally is BS.
Yes.
I've written about Josh Donaldson a lot this year, and I talked to a lot of guys who were with Oakland when he first came up, and they hated him when he first came up. Like, they couldn't stand him. And this is when he was still kind of a 4A player, wasn't hitting 40 home runs a year, you know, and they, when you have those kind of antics and when you do that stuff, I mean, you can even still see it with the old Bryce Harper, right, who is an MVP candidate, and Jonathan Papelbon doesn't appreciate it. And there's a lot of guys in the game who will say good for Papelbon for doing that.
You know? But yeah, I'm not sure, but given that Papelbon's a jerk, that changes that debate right there.
Absolutely.
Right? Because no one wants to play with Papelbon either. But
no.
But yeah, it's, if you're a 4A player and you're acting like you're a superstar, or you invented baseball, that would rub people very much the wrong way. If you're a superstar who acts like a superstar, you probably get away with it.
Last time the Blue Jays were in this position, you were at the Globe and Mail. It's 1992, 1993. Yes. And I'm curious how this situation right now is kind of similar, how it's different, if there's even a comparison to be made at all, or if that's just kind of us falling back on this is the last time it's happened.
It's different in a lot of ways. And I've been finding myself, because I, you know, managed to live this long, that I'm now I'm like the resident old guy, especially around this place where everybody's really young, to my mind. But 92 and 93 were the end of a long buildup.
Yeah.
You know, and so it had a different feel to it. You know, the team, so you got an expansion team that starts to get good in about year six, you know, 5 and 6, you start to see the signs, their own players start to come through the system, you know, first playoff in 85, they probably should have won the World Series that year. Still, won more games than any Jays team has ever won since. A bunch of near misses, horrible collapse in 87, you know, the Jimmy Williams firing in 89 and Cito coming in and get them to the playoffs after the terrible start, you know, then Oakland becomes their nemesis. And then they had, to bring in Tom Candiotti 1 year as a rental knuckleball pitcher and goes into the playoffs and refuses to throw his knuckleball, instead throws a knuckleballer's fastball, which didn't work that well. Sort of like Ari Dickey throwing a fastball. stumbled in 92, yeah. 90. So 92, 93, and they move into the new stadium in 89.
Right.
So you go into this, and so there's all this pent-up demand, and the place immediately fills up.
Yeah.
But it fills up with, you know, this is the biggest difference right now. It fills up with corporate people.
Right.
Right? Because it's like, you know, it's like the Leafs.
It's the hot ticket.
Yeah. It's the hot ticket. And so, and who buys season's tickets? You know, people, you know, who buys 81 season's tickets?
People who have the means to.
So it had a, it was a much more sedate place. You know, it was enthusiastic when they won. And in those playoffs in 92, 93, there, you know, kind of spontaneous street celebrations broke out anytime they won a game. Same as they did for the Leafs in 93 when they went to the conference final against the Kings, you know. It, so it wasn't like there wasn't any of that kind of spontaneous stuff, but it was a different, it was more kind of the fulfilling of a long-held destiny and I'd say a kind of a decade-long build-up to it. This thing, you know, I think those of us who've been close to it and get access to things like TV numbers, you could see that with the 2013 Marlins trade and the interest that year leading into that season.
Yeah.
And even last year, you know, which is kind of a weird wheel-spinning season, you could see kind of where the TV numbers were. And I also sensed the flipping demographic.
Right.
You know, that there were times during the Ricciardi years and the Paul Godfrey years, you go down to the stadium and everybody was, you know, it was like Remember When night, right? Yeah. You know, it's, I got a buddy in the music business who looks at crowds like that. He calls them Q-tips.
Right.
Because it's white heads, right?
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, Q-tips. The whole place was Q-tips because that's who went to baseball.
Yeah.
And so at the same time as the team suddenly gives people, the organization gives people more of a reason to buy in and kind of starts to beat back some of the cynicism, you have this parallel, really, evolution of a young, hip baseball demo.
Right.
People who are engaged in the game, you know, and the world in which we operate lends itself to that, the conversation you can have around the game, which, you know, back in 92, 93, which is, you know, not technically pre-internet, but effectively pre-internet.
Yeah.
You've got, you know, the conversation is the sports pages and talk radio is in its infancy. Sports talk radio in this country is in its infancy. Mm-hmm. And all sports TV is even in its infancy, really. So it's not, there wasn't all this other content spinning around it all the time. And now, of course, it's self-created content. So you have this unbelievable kind of, like the rings of Saturn, you know, circling the team. So it's a perfect storm. You know, I know that's a cliche, but so you've got a team gives people hope. Demographic starts to flip for reasons that I don't know why, but a younger generation that is supposed to be, like, you know, just to step back, there was a time, I remember when, you know, when the NBA started to kind of package games in a certain way, they were the first people to use music effectively and, you know, break and stuff during the breaks and all of that. And there was a sense that that was the way sports was going to go.
Right.
That if you couldn't keep people distracted and entertained for every second they were there, they were not going to watch. You know, which is why Howard Cosell famously came out and declared baseball dead at some point when he was doing, right after he quit Monday Night Baseball. Said, this sport is, there was a Monday Night Baseball in addition to Monday Night Football, kids. But instead, this sport's, it's too old, too slow, 19th century sport. It's got no future. People need stimulation. And it's funny because we've swung around now and it's still the same sport, but the kind of filling in the blanks part has an attraction for people, right? The fact that you have to engage with baseball, otherwise it is boring.
Right.
You have to go, you have to participate in being a spectator because otherwise it's not, it doesn't come at you.
Yeah.
And people, there's a layer of people, you know, who didn't grow up with it that same way, who I think have come to appreciate it, you know? And it's not just numbers guys, but it is, you know, that's part of it. So the Marlins deal spikes interest. Last year's kind of a wheel spinning year, but you can still look, if you look at those TV numbers, you see the sleeping giant, right? You can just say, my God, there's a lot of, you know, this is a crappy game on a Tuesday night and there's still 600,000 or 700,000 people watching this game, which is a pretty good number.
Yeah.
So what would happen if they ever got good?
Right.
And this year provided the answer.
So
it's different, right? And it feels like, you know, what it's been like the last 3 months have been like a hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
It's been
perfect storm. Like
perfect.
You said.
And spontaneous and kind of beautiful, right? It's like, I sound corny, but if you don't get kind of swept up in the fun of this, you shouldn't be doing this job.
Right. And I that's such a fascinating thought that baseball really is a sport that you have to engage with and you have to dig deeper. And it's something that, and you know, you'd say that, you know, attention spans have probably gotten worse since that time that you were mentioning.
They're,
you know,
supposed to have. Everybody says that, right?
Right? When, you know, when they were saying baseball is dead, right? Like, you know, people are supposed to want more like immediate, snappy, quick, one and done kind of, you know, entertainment. Whereas baseball is a sport that you have to dig deeper into. And now people have this tool, the internet, to do that.
That's right. And talk to like-minded people.
Right.
Right. So you can immediately be in a conversation of your chosen peers, right? You have this community that you're part of, which is part of it. And, you know, that wasn't, you know, that, look, in 1992-93, in the same way as it is now, every conversation could take you to baseball. You could call your grandmother up and she would talk to you. If you got in a cab, they would have the ball game on the radio. And if they didn't, you could demand that they put it on.
Right.
You know, you could have an intelligent baseball conversation just the same as you can now. And I don't also discount the notion that winning period is a big part of it, because this city especially.
Yeah.
But, you know, that doesn't explain why, you know, I'm in Newfoundland all summer, you know, and you know why the guys at the Legion suddenly want to talk about it, you know, or, you know, why, you know, the kind of, even in Montreal, you know, when we went there for the exhibition games this year, there was a sense of, you know, they talking Jays in Montreal, you can never do.
Right.
And so there's kind of something happened. And that feels to me fundamentally different than it did 20 years ago.
I feel like those people who are new to this game kind of, they discovered this cornucopia of information and of insight and of, you know, different ways of looking at it. And they all of a sudden they realize, oh, like, you just have to hear one person kind of talk about baseball on another level. And you realize, oh my God, there's so much I don't know.
You know, the other thing is I've clued into is that it's immersive.
Yeah.
And one of the things that people like about the Olympics, right? People can stand back from the Olympics and say, look, I don't care about 99% of these sports, right? Yeah. I don't care about Taekwondo or cycling or modern pentathlon and all that stuff, you know, and I don't even buy into the, you know, Olympism and the phony religion stuff and all that, you know, the stuff that's attached to it. I don't buy into any of that. And the, you know, the torch rally, you know, the Nazis invented that.
Yeah.
But what happens during the 17 days is people immerse themselves in it.
Yeah.
So it's on all the time. And you can flip in and get your fix, and you start to become, you live in Olympic world for 17 days. And so on day 18, people kind of go, what am I going to do with my life? You know, that's why it's a great thing, but that's why the Paralympics have, because it's become like the continuation of the, like, we need more. I don't want to stop doing this. This is how I'm living my life now. But baseball, 162. Plus spring training, you know, plus the postseason, plus the winter meetings and you know, right now people are getting up, going to work, and then they're thinking about watching the ball game at night.
Mm-hmm.
And during the day, they're talking about the ball game and they're settling in saying, no, we can't go out for dinner tonight. Yeah. Or if we're going to go, we got to go somewhere there's a TV. Or they're sitting there, you know, at a wedding, you know, looking at their phone.
Right. Yeah.
It's that immersive quality about it that, you know, that you don't get with, you know, like NFL.
Yeah.
I know lots of people that dedicate Sunday, just say, that's it. Don't talk to me.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning pre-games and midnight after the late game. But this is every night. And I think that's part of it, too. It's that it's become like a 162-game Olympics.
Right. And I wonder how this run will affect kind of people going forward. When you look at how that, you know, the dust of 92-93 still inflects everything we talk about when it comes to this team. You know, it's still, we still see the banners in center field.
Are the young folks bored with that, by the way? Like they are with the, you know, the baby boomers dominating music culture for 30 years after it was relevant. Like I wonder about that.
This
sometimes
is what I'm wondering, because it could shift the paradigm of this franchise depending on how this thing shakes out, and probably more so depending on how things go next year and maybe even the year after and how this group does. But I mean, this is just kind of, this is, could be the second great era of Blue Jays baseball when you look at 85 to 93 to now. And it started with that Marlins trade.
It did. You know, as flawed as that was, it was still taking the opportunity, you know, and again, I give Alex a lot of marks for that, understanding that he had a chance for a bunch of reasons with ownership. You know, they were trying to bury the whole John Farrell thing and bury the whole Yunel Escobar thing and make people forget how horrible the end of that season was. And this opportunity presents itself in one fell swoop. And the guys, of course, the money guys here said, do you guarantee we'll win if we do this? And they had to say yes, right?
Yeah.
They, you guess, of course, that's the only answer you're going to give, right?
Of course.
We will win if you do this. So they do it. Then they don't win. But that will still be remembered as kind of the pivot point, I think, when people go back, sort of like the Alomar Carter trade was for the World Series teams.
That's the beginning of this kind of new, I don't know, epoch or era.
Yeah, but it's interesting you say, you know, there's this kind of, it does change, you know, obviously it changes the kind of mythology around the team, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Right?
Because
absolutely.
It's not just...
They're out of the wilderness.
Yeah, when. And you know, people, you know, 20 years from now, people will be telling their kids about this season. Yeah. I guarantee you, whatever happens now, they will, because it's been so cool.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's right now you look at this team and you say, okay, they've got a real shot at, you know, they could lose in the LDS. I understand that. But they could also beat everybody.
Yeah.
They're good enough to beat everybody right now. And then you look at next year and you say, you know, they're in a pretty good spot here.
Yeah.
And the year after that, yeah, you know, they're not in a bad, they give up a ton of prospects, but they've still, they still got, you know, kind of core starting pitching that's 22 and 23 years old, you know, that's not terrible. You know, it's not going to last forever,
right.
But you do get the sense that this could go for a while. And then it's not just how that changes the history of the team. It's kind of how it changes the sports landscape in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think one of the things we've seen this year
is
that this can be a baseball country.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's not just this city. It's not just the city. It's the country. Really, it's you don't do $3 million television or $3 million person television numbers just in Toronto.
No, and wait till the playoffs. You know, then you're going to start seeing big hockey / Olympic numbers. And, you know, if you look around North America, you know, with the possible exception of St. Louis, which is sort of the baseball Bethlehem. Yeah. Jerusalem, whatever, right? It's the like baseball is number one in St. Louis. It's one place in the United States where it's always number one.
Yeah.
Where else in North America is baseball as happening as it is right here, right now?
Kansas City, maybe.
Yeah, because it's fresh there too, right? Dead for a lot of years.
They're kind of doing the exact same thing.
So, so it's all in Missouri.
Yeah.
but really, this is, you know, this is a place where, and you know, and this is not, we're not talking about 5 million people in Toronto. We're talking about 38 million people in Canada.
And I love watching the away broadcasts, and I love listening to guys who come through here from other teams who are, you know, some of the Tampa Bay guys on the weekend were saying, I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to see the stadium, because they've been seeing it on television.
Yes.
And they've been seeing 50,000 people going nuts. Like, I can't wait to experience that atmosphere, because that's getting out through the U.S. market that there's something going on.
Yeah. And it's not, and I say, I like it because it's not, no one scripted it. You know?
Yeah. It wasn't supposed to happen like this.
It wasn't supposed to happen. Right. No one anticipated those. As I say, the tickets didn't all wind up in the hands of corporate guys and scalpers. They actually, some real people bought those tickets and jumped in and said, now the postseason, you know, it's going to be interesting because a lot of those people aren't going to be there for the postseason games. Like, we're all going to have to wrap our heads around that too. Yeah. It may be a little different.
Yeah.
But it's spontaneous, and it can only be like this time.
Right.
Next year will be great.
Yeah.
But it'll be different.
Yeah.
This is a one-off.
It'll be so interesting to me how people look back on this season. Like, because you remember, you know, names like Kelly Gruber and like Candy Maldonado, like, stick out with you, because those are guys who were kind of, in a sense, heroes at certain times during those 92-93 runs.
Pat Borders, MVP in World Series.
Completely unremarkable ballplayers.
Yep.
Guys that didn't have very good careers at all. And those are names that have lasted for two decades. Does a Kevin Pillar and a Ryan Goins, you know?
Kevin Pillar's already had a TV special. Are you kidding me? he's already, he's that guy. He's because he's both, right? He's the plucky underdog, which much beloved by Toronto in all sports, right? They've always been more willing to cheer for a Reed Johnson than Vernon Wells, right?
Yeah.
So plucky underdog who also is really good.
Right.
No, he's perfect. He's Wendell Clark.
Right. And so does that name then become, you know, is he coming back to the Rogers Center in 2040, you know, for a ceremony or something like that? Can you imagine?
Yeah, I can, and I can.
Yeah.
I can. And it's not, that doesn't mean it's forever. You know, it doesn't mean that 5 years from now we've been saying, geez, the Jays are scuffling and, you know, what's going on with you? Or they're firing the manager they're whacking payroll because they're going to take it down to the wood and there's going to be a long rebuild, or, you know, take your pick, right? And, you know, you can look around Major League Baseball and just about every place had its moment where there was kind of a frenzy, right? Yeah. You know, and, you know, maybe not in Florida. It always seemed to, even when the Rays were good and Marlins were good, it never seemed frenzy-ish to me, right?
Pro sports in Florida. Yeah, something about it.
There is something about it. But you know, you can remember kind of crazy times in Houston or, right. you know, Seattle or any, yeah. any number of places. So, yeah, that some of this will pass. But I say what is happening now, if you are not enjoying it, if you haven't kind of stepped back and said, boy, this is something,
yeah.
then you're going to regret that. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand people don't give a damn about sports. But if you buy into it at all, you know, and this is the stuff you live your life waiting for.
That's an absolutely prescient thing to say, I think. Yeah, if you're not, you know, it's waking up and saying, like, this is the coolest, you know, moment.
Right now.
Yeah.
Right now. Yeah. It might not ever, and that, you know, they might, who knows, I say, without knowing what's going to happen in this postseason.
They could lose in three.
But it might not feel any better than it feels right this moment. So just wallow and enjoy. It's funny, I heard a guy, you know, Wilner's show. I love Wilner.
Yeah.
And, you know, but Wilner's show is at its best when things are going badly, right? Mm-hmm. So
it's most entertaining, at least.
Yeah. yeah. And so, but you know, it was during this phase after things had turned. And some guy phoned in and he said, yeah, it's really great what's going now, but I'm really excited about 2016. I said, stop. No, don't. You know, we all might all be dead. We might be hit by an asteroid in 2016.
Right.
Stop. You know, smell the roses. Look around. This is it. This is it. And that yeah. feeling you get, you know, waiting for the game tonight, yeah. you might never get that again. Yeah. So live it. Live it and enjoy it.
That's why some of the, you know, well, are they going to pick up R.A. Dickey's option? I mean, who's going to pitch for this team next year?
Yeah, what if Dan Norris might be a superstar? boy, I wish we had Syndergaard.
Yeah.
No.
Forget it.
We're going to win the World yeah. Series, or maybe not. But it doesn't matter. You know, nothing's better
than
what you're feeling right now.
Part of there not being playoff baseball here for so long, I think, is people aren't realizing how quickly it's going to go. Like, the ALDS, 5 games.
Yeah.
It could be over in 3. That's nothing. That's yeah. less than a week.
Still beats a wild card.
Oh, absolutely, right? Which is the ultimate. Like,
yeah.
But, you know, I don't think people realize just how, you know, the last 2 months even might be better than what's about to come.
Yes.
In a sense.
Yeah, it's possible. You yeah. know, and again, funny things happen. Yeah. Great teams lose. I'm not... You know, like I say, it's better than LDS than in a total crapshoot of a wild card game. But
yeah.
I'm not predicting. What I'm predicting is that they're in the postseason and yeah. they haven't been in a dog's age. And it's been the best 3 months of baseball in the history of the Blue Jays, as far as I'm concerned. I don't think there's been a better stretch as a fan
yeah.
than the end of July till now.
For you professionally, and you can. You know, me too, but I just got into this. Like, for you, having worked, you know, covered sports in this city for so long and in this country and seen everything that's gone on here, with you go through the Expos and the Jays lean years, and you can look at, you know, the cluster F that has been the Leafs for so long. I mean, what, you know, what's this mean to you professionally to get to cover this?
It's, you know, it's not so much about, it's funny. It's because I know I have a different relationship because like you, I work for a company that owns the team, right? It's kind of it changes things, right? And,
yeah.
and you know, one of the things that's meant is that I've had great access. You know, right. I've also been able to spend a lot of time around this team in a way, and in a kind of a non-threatening way
yeah.
to these guys, you know, because, it's not that we're all in this together. We still have a responsibility, but it's a different vibe, right? I'm not just the guy standing at somebody's locker waiting for a post-game quote.
Yeah.
I've got a chance to get to know people and have conversations with people. And I'm okay. You know, the great edict of, you know, my profession is no cheering in the press box. Right. You know, but what that often creeps into is cynicism, that people, you know, bloody mindedness, right. You start to hate the people you cover. And I've seen it a million times, even some of those Jays teams, not so much 92 and 93, but certainly those teams in the 80s, like the guys that covered those teams hated some of those guys. You know, really? Doyle Alexander's a horrible person, right? Dave right. Steeb, you know, I did the piece about him. You know, he was an awful guy to deal with. There were some miserable yeah. SOBs. Jim Acker, you know, I can remember these guys being real jerks.
Yeah.
Really? And you didn't like spending the 162 with them, and you didn't yeah. really want them to win in the end. You were just as happy when you were cheering for sweeps in the playoffs so you could go home.
Really?
Honestly. Yeah. And so the ability to kind of not do that
yeah.
and to say, you know, I think Eddie Encarnacion's a really good guy, or I really like John Gibbons, even though, you know, I wouldn't want to talk politics with him. or that I think Alex Anthopoulos has done a spectacular job yeah. and it couldn't have happened to a better person. You know, it's okay to be able to feel those things and think those things. And, you know, it allows you to enjoy the success of it without kind of being a miserable old sports writer. I never wanted to be a miserable old sports writer. I like being a sports writer, but I never wanted to be one of those guys necessarily. And so it's doubly pleasant for me to be able to kind of cover this team professionally, you know, cover the beyond this story that everybody's talking about. You always right. want to do that. You know, you don't want to be covering broomball when the Jays are winning a World Series, but also to kind of, yeah, feel good about, you know, feel good for them. Right. I know Blair tweeted out something the other day about Gibby. He said that, you know, in the 35 years or whatever, he's been covering sports.
Yeah.
He's never been happier for an individual having success than John. And I'm right there. It's good to be able to say that, yeah. right? Not
no. well, honestly say that.
Maintain yeah. my professional distance here. And, yeah. you know, if they fire him next year, well, what, the, you know, that's yeah. the way it goes. You know, I like John Gibbons. I think he's a good guy. Mm-hmm. And I am happy that he's had success. And I'm happy this team's had success.
Yeah. You hear the way some players get talked about when they have success. It says, oh, well, you know, he's worked really hard for it. Or, you know, or like, yeah, he's put up, you know, he's had a lot of great seasons, right? But you never hear like, oh, yeah, I'm really happy for that guy. I'm really happy for Alex Anthopoulos.
Yeah, me too.
You know, after this season, especially where, you know, 3 months ago, you know, we were getting questions and tweets and all that stuff about when are they going to fire AA? When are they going to fire Gibbons? You know, when are they? And I was like, well, you know, this, you can't think of a better guy. And even of just like the cult of MLB general managers, just a great, great person Alex Anthopoulos is.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say that straight yeah. up. And again, I'm not into vouching for people's character, but yeah, he's a good guy. You know, if he was your neighbor, he'd be a great guy. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd be really happy to live next door to him. And, yeah. you know, there may be a time when he deserves to get fired. They all yeah. do at some point, right?
Right.
Managers for sure.
Yeah.
You know, like Cito had a great run, but when his time came, it was time. You know, it was probably yeah. overtime.
Yeah.
John's run will end here. Alex's run will end here at some point. But yeah, they're good, solid folks, and they've done a good job. I don't have to be an apologist for them. They've done a really good job. I'll debate that up and down with anybody who wants to. And I would have done it in terms of John Gibbons, you know, back in April when everybody said he was going to get fired by June 1st.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I think he's a very solid manager. You know, and you're dealt the hand you're dealt. I would argue for his, especially his handling of the bullpen.
Yeah.
I would argue that with anybody who wants to.
Managed a perfect game last night.
Yeah, that was nice, wasn't it?
Really well managed. And it's a different discussion if Carlos Tosca is having this success as Blue Jays manager.
It could be, right? It could be, yeah.
That's a guy that, I mean, didn't have a very good relationship with a lot of guys here.
Yeah, I wasn't around the team yeah. a ton during his relatively short tenure, but you're right, yeah. You know, I think John, you know, he's had a kind of a fractious relationship with a couple of guys, but he does it with a smile on his face, and you know, he jousts with them a little bit. I'm sure there's certainly been some guys who've gotten his goat, and yeah. there would have been guys who would have been on the first on the fire Gibby line,
right?
If things had gone, you know, I always thought that was the cheapest trick in the book, you know, for a sports writer: fire the coach, yeah. fire the manager,
mm-hmm.
you know. I want to, you know, and these days especially, it's like guys want to be first.
Yeah.
You know, it's like stupid guys on comment strings and wanting to be first.
Right.
First, fire Gibby, you know, first. Well, it's never that simple,
yeah.
you know, and it is somebody's livelihood you're talking about in their life. You know, look, there's certainly been guys I didn't like very much in those kind of jobs, but I think it's kind of cheap to throw that around.
The thing about John Gibbons is he never takes himself too seriously. He never takes the game too seriously. Like you know, a lot of Toronto fans said, we need that proven manager. Like, we need that, you know, baseball lifer guy. Like, John Gibbons is that guy.
Yeah.
You go on, watch him on the road, and there's a lineup of guys from other teams, other organizations want to come say hi to Gibby and pay their respects. And John Gibbons has never taken himself too seriously. And it's just, there is an ego there, but it's like,
yeah.
Well,
he was a hot prospect, this guy, right? Yeah. He was a high draft pick. He was a glamour boy player. You know, it didn't pan out for him. Got
Blue
hurt.
Was bonus on a sports car, right?
Blue was bonus on a sports car. he's not, Blair and I were talking about this on the show a little bit today, but, you know, he's also not a guy who, they've all got ego. We've all got egos.
Yeah.
But he's not a self-promoter in the sense, like, there are a lot of guys in the managerial business even who've learned that it's, you know, you can kind of build your brand, right? And it helps you get the next job,
yeah.
right? If you get fired from this one, because then they don't blame you. They say, well, geez, that guy was a genius, but, you know, the players sucked or the organization sucked. You know, and it's not, I'm not saying it's contrived, but like Joe Madden, he's done a hell of a job of building his brand. He was really good too,
mm-hmm.
but he built his brand in a market where no one gives a damn about baseball, right? In an empty stadium, you had people coming up to him and, you know, kind of you know, handing him genius credentials, right?
Yeah.
And it got him a great gig in Chicago and a load of money. Mm-hmm. And he's really good.
A lot of that success on the field, too.
Tony La Russa did the same thing, though, right? You know, if you wanted to know how smart Tony La Russa was, just ask Tony La Russa. He'd tell you. right. But, you know, but Gibby's not that guy, right? He's not in the Gibby business. Maybe he should be a little more.
Mm. I don't know if he wants to be.
I don't think it's his nature.
I don't think he's after, you know, a big payday in a sense.
And I found a lot of the people who criticized him, you know, it's a lot of the criticism he endured, same thing with Cito in a lot of ways, but they're, you know, kind of perceived passive, you know, being too much of a, you know, the way he sat in the dugout or the way he sounded.
He seems laissez-faire.
Laissez-faire. He's not, why doesn't he do something? He kept there and manage. Yeah. Go manage in front of us. Manage some things. And I think that the accent, you know, people have a hard time. I know we did the TV thing with him. One of the funniest things in the world is the fact, you know, he sounds like, you know, a character from King of the Hill, right?
But he does.
But his mom sounds like a Kennedy, right? She sounds, his mom's from Massachusetts. His dad, they moved down there because the dad worked on the army base there. But they're Northeastern people, right? And the mom sounds, you know, she sounds like J.P. Ricciardi.
Yeah.
And the two of them together is the funniest conversation on earth. So, but again, I think surfacey stuff sometimes. People just, and they don't really, and I think the other thing is that people, and again, fans can think what they want, but, you know, managing a baseball team isn't about when you hit and run. You know, it's about bullpen's about 75% of it in American League, especially.
Yeah,
you know, you get your bullpen decisions right, everything else is going to take care of itself.
Set the lineup,
and then it's what Blair, the soccer guy, would call man management. You know, keeping the guys who hate each other apart, being consistent, setting a tone, not getting in the way, you know, and not imposing yourself, but also not being absentee.
With Gibby, it's kind of the dumb as a fox thing, right?
Yep.
Where it's like he gets underestimated because he does play the, you know, hey, I'm just, he plays that card of like, you know, I'm not the genius manager kind of, but he is.
And there's guys on this team, and you know, you've been around the team, and I know there's guys on this team he's gotten along with better than with others.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? There's some oil and water mixes there in terms of his personality.
Yeah.
But some of those guys are very prominent players on the team, and they have contributed, and they've had great seasons with him as their manager.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing you got to make work.
He's really evolved in the way that he handles a guy like Jose Bautista, the way he handles a guy like R.A. Dickey, the way that he communicates to certain players, the Kevin Pillar incident last year.
Yep.
And Gibby, I've really seen Gibby grow and change as a manager in the way that he handles his players in his clubhouse from the way that he did 2 years ago.
Well, and, you know, go back to his first incarnation, of course. He's learned a lot from that, you know, Ted Lilly and et cetera. But
Shea Hillenbrand.
But, I think after the Marlins trade, he was put in a weird spot because he suddenly, you know, there's all these guys, you know, it's a new team for him.
Yeah.
But B, there's all these guys who are, you know, 60 Minutes is trailing R.A. Dickey around.
Yeah.
Jose Bautista is kind of stewing quietly in one corner of the clubhouse because
not the big dog anymore.
Yeah. Jose Reyes shows up. Colby Rasmus is a mystery, you know, an enigma wrapped in a, you know, whatever. Adam Lind was a puzzle to him. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think he was kind of, he almost felt he had to step back and just let it happen because, you know, those guys were figuring each other out, right? And plus he'd got the job. He didn't expect to get the job, right? He wasn't a big name. You know, he was a smaller name than half the guys in the clubhouse. So I think that was a tricky year for him. And I think he learned a lot. I thought last year you could see his comfort starting to grow.
Yeah.
And then this year in spring training, I think he thought, you know what, if this thing tanks, I'm going to get fired anyway.
Right.
I'm going to trust my instincts. And I think you're right though. I think he's grown in a lot of ways and certainly is. I think he has found a way to deal with the guys who might not be the guys he would go fishing with on a Saturday afternoon.
And there's been a lot, you know, I always remember John Gibbons at certain points this season would joke around with us and say, oh, we got Houston next week. Yeah, maybe I'll just stick around. Maybe I just won't leave Texas.
Yeah, I know.
That would be fitting.
Well, I remember telling the story of him, you know, when he got fired the first time around in Pittsburgh, right? And he kind of sort of knew it was coming and the family flew up and they jumped in their minivan and made the long, sad drive back to San Antonio. But I think part of him was relieved.
Yeah.
Part of him was quite happy just to go back home. Just let's get away from this crap. You know, so
he doesn't need it.
I don't think he needs it. And I think the day it's over, he'll be okay. But in the meantime, I hope he gets paid a lot of money. I don't know what he'll spend it on.
Right.
Because he's not the most...
Cowboy boots.
Yeah, he's not the most materialistic guy I've ever met.
Sweet fishing lure.
Yes, they know, and I'm sure he'll get a real good truck.
Yeah.
Oh, he'll have a real good truck. But he'll live in the same house in San Antonio. And I hope he gets some of the glory. He deserves it. He should be a hero in this town. The guy should be a hero. People should love him. Mm-hmm. Now, anybody who doesn't is missing out.
And it's so tied to the performance of the team. Because, you know, I think right now you see a lot more Gibby the best rather than, you know, a lot more Fire Gibby.
Yeah.
Right? Where when they were losing. It's the same with Alex. And Alex is similarly a guy who has evolved over his time.
He has. And I think he'd be the first guy to tell you that. The learning curve continues.
2 or 3 years ago, he maybe trades for Jonathan Papelbon, right? You know, you look at the Yunel Escobar and the Brett Laurie and some of the character issues that he overlooked to bring in talented guys. He doesn't make those moves now.
He'll tell you, you know, if you, he'll probably tell you on the record, but, you know, but he would say, you know, the John Farrell thing, mm-hmm. the Yunel Escobar thing, both affected him profoundly, you know, in terms of like that's, you know, Gibby is a direct result of the John Farrell thing, right?
Yeah.
I want a guy here I can trust.
Yeah.
You know, who's my guy, who I know. The Yunel Escobar thing, they made a hash of it, you know, organizationally. You know, we're not going to let things spin out of control. There's some other issues with players off the field or what their perceived behavior was off the field that affected the way he built this team that we're watching now.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
That's learning, and he, you know, he said it. I think he said it publicly. All that stuff last year about the what an unlikable team the Toronto Maple Leafs were as they were quitting on their coach at the end of the season.
Yeah.
He took some of that stuff to heart too.
Yeah. I think you have to give guys a chance to develop and a chance to evolve. Whereas, you know, people who wanted to fire John Gibbons after two seasons, wanted to fire Alex Anthopoulos after five years as a general manager just isn't a lot. Still, especially a first-time general manager.
Well, plus, Harden, look at his draft record.
Yeah,
you know, like it's not about just, you know, it's not all about the here and now with the GM, right? Yeah. Look at his draft record. So look at the guys they dealt and the guys they still have.
Yeah.
Like I'll take that. You know, I think he drafted pretty well.
Absolutely. That 2010 draft, one of his first, was phenomenal.
Yeah. So, you know, and, some slightly under the radar stuff. Now, you know, I don't know what Miguel Castro is going to turn into, but there's a really interesting guy they picked up in the Dominican way under the radar. Yeah. The Vlady Guerrero Jr. thing, it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. You know, they went in and invested big dough in that guy. But, you know, this is not – I think you've got to look at the totality of his work and not just one trade or one season.
Yeah, I feel like that gut reaction of just, all right, change this, fire – something, you know, the team isn't winning, something has to be changed. Well, no, you have to give these people a chance to learn and to grow. Wouldn't you rather have stability in your front office and in your manager seat rather than this rotating cast of people with three-year plans?
Well, look around baseball, right? Yeah. And look at the, you know, what organization do you want to be when you grow up? You know, you
St. Louis Cardinals.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, and what's the hallmark of that team? Continuity, right?
Stability.
Yeah, yeah. They do it, and they have an organizational culture, mm-hmm. which, you know, it's a chicken and egg thing. Does success breed culture or culture breed success? But, you know, they've had both. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, that's who you want to be.
The Cardinal way. Just don't ask Joe Madden about it.
Yeah. Yeah. There is. Yes.
Oh, Brian, I appreciate you doing this.
It's been cool. I liked it. It's been fun. Do it again.
I could keep you here for hours, but I'll let you go.
Thank you. I've got to go do one of my other 12 jobs.
All right. That's Stephen Brunt. Thank you so much for coming along. We'll be back on At the Letters.
Josh Donaldson with 3 walk-off hits this season.
Well, what more can you say about that? Stephen Brunt doing Stephen Brunt things. As I said to him at the end, I mean, I could talk to that man for hours about the Toronto Blue Jays. He brings such a unique perspective, such an interesting perspective, and such an informed one. So I have to send my immense thanks and gratitude to Mr. Brunt for joining us today on At the Letters. My thanks to my producer, Sam McKee. At Sam_Alton_McKee behind the ones and twos. Thank you to him for doing everything. My name's Arden Zwelling. You can find me on Twitter at Arden Zwelling. Ben Nicholson Smith's on Twitter at B Nicholson Smith. A couple things. You should be checking out sportsnet.ca every day, regardless. But, you know, you should do it, especially right now, as we're going to have plenty of Blue Jays postseason coverage. And there is a play of the season vote that you can take care of, or at sportsnet.ca, you can go and vote for whoever had the best play. It's pretty cool. I recommend you do that. Also on sportsnet.ca, it's a cool podcast by the name of Free Association. It's our Raptors and NBA podcast. This week on that podcast, Dave Zarum and JD Bunkus are live on tape from Raptors Media Day, where they find out which NBA player James Johnson would fight in an MMA bout, what brought FIBA gold medalist Luis Scola to Toronto. Also, DeMar DeRozan and Terrence Ross step up to the plate for the first free association questionnaire of 2015-2016. So definitely listen to that. As Raptors season gets going, that podcast is going to be your place and your source for the best Raptors information. They've had Masai Ujiri on that podcast. They've had other players and some great guests. It's always an interesting, engaging, entertaining, and informative discussion with the dudes, JD Bunkus and Dave Zarum. So I recommend that you listen to that. And hey, listen to us. We are at the Letters. We will be with you throughout the playoffs, giving you that sweet, sweet Blue Jays content that you so desire. It's going to be great. You're going to love it. I'm honestly really, really excited for the next month, just for covering this Blue Jays postseason run. It might only last a week. It might only last three games. Who knows? It's still going to be really, really cool to see postseason baseball at the Rogers Center. This is something that, I mean, I was 6 in 1993 and 5 in 1992. I don't have any memory of that. I've never seen this at a stage in my life where I'm making memories. It's going to be so, so, so cool to see it. And as you know, as Brent and I kind of talked about, you need to enjoy it. You need to enjoy this moment. You need to really look around, smell the roses, and take this in, because this is such a rare opportunity, such a rare moment for this franchise. So many teams don't get to do what the Toronto Blue Jays are doing right now. So many fans don't get to witness a season like the Toronto Blue Jays have given you. Like, Josh Donaldson won the last home game of the regular season with an incredible walk-off. I mean, it's storybook stuff. I highly encourage you to enjoy it and to live up this moment to the fullest over the next month. Thanks for coming along with us. I'm at the Letters. My name's Arvin Zwelling. For Stephen Brunt, for Sam McKee, thank you so much. This has been ATL.